Okay, everyone, good morning. And so let us get started with the suttas. And as always on these retreats, I'm going to start off with a few generalities, just to have a look at the ideas of the suttas in the broader perspective, what the purpose of the suttas are, and how kind of a broader bird's eye view before we kind of delve into the actual Noble Eightfold Path. So that is going to be what we're going to do this morning. Then gradually we'll move into the actual Noble Eightfold Path and look at the various factors, etc. So the very first sutta today is a very simple sutta, or at least it seems very simple. It's called the Listening to the Dhamma. It's just about why it is so important, what the purpose of the suttas are, why they actually matter so much. So this very simple little thing. So this is how it goes. There are these five benefits in listening to the Dhamma. What five? One hears what one has not heard. One clarifies what has been heard. One emerges from perplexity. One straightens out one's view. One's mind becomes placid. These are the five benefits in listening to the Dhamma. So there you are, very simple idea, yeah? And this is what we're going to be doing over the next 10 days, 9 days. We're going to be listening to Dhamma teachings. And when we talk about the Dhamma, of course, we're talking about really the teachings of the Buddha. So what we find in the four Nikayas, etc. So the benefits here, they may seem very straightforward, but actually there is quite a lot going on here in this simple outline of what listening to the suttas is all about. So first of all, you hear what you have not heard before. And this may sound it may sound superficially easy to understand what this is about, but the point about the Buddha's teaching is that these teachings are so profound in many ways, so different from what you normally can hear in the world, that without hearing things from someone who has some profound insight, who has a different understanding of reality, it is actually impossible to get to hear these things apart from hearing it from a Buddha or someone else who has the same kind of realization. So this is literally hearing what you cannot hear anywhere else. Yeah, this is what the idea of insight is, seeing things according to reality. That you have to actually find that teacher, that Kalyanamitta, which is the Buddha, to guide you. The standard sutta, which explains the importance of the Kalyanamitta, is actually found in the chapter on the Noble Eightfold Path, actually, and also elsewhere, also found in the famous sutta, the Mahanidhana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the great discourse on causation. I think it's Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation there. In that sutta, many of you will know this already, because I say this on every retreat, so please forgive me if I keep on repeating myself, but I like to repeat myself. This is the weird thing here. Because I think it's always inspiring and always nice to bring these things up again and again and again. Every time you hear it, it sinks in a little bit deeper. You hear it from a slightly different angle. So that is really the point of this. And in this sutta, what happens is that Venerable Ananda comes to the Buddha. And Venerable Ananda has had some kind of insight. He has kind of been thinking about the Dhamma. And he goes to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, Bhagava, Lord or Master or whatever you want to call, translate the word Bhagava. I have realized that Kalyanamitta, noble friendship, spiritual friendship, is 50%, it's half of the holy life. And you hear that and you always think, surely he's exaggerating. How can Kalyanamitta be 50% of the holy life? There's so many other things to do. You've got to be kind, you've got to be nice, you've got to do meditation practice, good to be generous, you have to learn to think in the right way. 50% surely is an exaggeration. And then the Buddha replies to Venerable Ananda. He says, no, Ananda, do not say so. Do not say so, Ananda. Noble friendship, spiritual friendship, is not 50% of the holy life. It is 100% of the holy life. And you think, if Ananda is exaggerating, surely the Buddha is exaggerating even more. The Buddha is really, And of course, after a while, after reading this for many years, after a while, you realize the Buddha doesn't really exaggerate. If he says things, he means it in that particular way. He doesn't try to make things... if anything, he tends to downplay things. He tends to be, be a bit reticent, and things often have a very lofty meaning, even though he uses very ordinary words. So the point, of course, is, and this is what this is all about, what we're seeing right here, is that when we come into this world, we are lacking an understanding of reality. We don't have that understanding with us. And we are basically deluded about the nature of existence. And because we are deluded about it, we need a circuit breaker. We need something to kind of bring us out of that delusion and see things in the right way. The problem with delusion is that delusion tends to be self-perpetuating. If you are deluded, it tends to carry on. Yeah, delusion begets delusion, begets more delusion. And it keeps on going and going and going in this vicious circle from life to life to life. And unless you find that circuit breaker, something to bring you out of that, there is no way you can actually come out. So 100% of the holy life, because it is absolutely necessary to even get started with the Buddhist ideas and getting practicing on this path, to get insight, to get all of these things that are fundamental on the Buddhist path. And of course, the reason why this is so, it comes back to this very profound idea of non-self. Yeah, non-self is very profound. It's very counterintuitive, because each one of you, if you feel about yourself, it feels like you are here. Yeah, it feels like you are an independent entity who makes your own choices. Yeah, you decided to come here, right, to this retreat. Yeah, it's nobody else's fault. You decided that. Maybe it's the Buddha's fault. Yeah, blame the Buddha if you don't. So the point is that we are. Entirely conditioned. We are the sum total of the conditions and circumstances and influences that work upon us. That's who we are. We are not independent entities that cannot decide what we do in the world. We are almost like floating around. Yeah. And if the circumstances push us one way, we go that way. If the circumstances push us that way, we go that way. So when you hear the word of the Buddha, and this is kind of the powerful influencing, the powerful condition of hearing the word of the Buddha, you hear it, you think, yeah, wow, this is so good. That means that you are being brainwashed, yeah? Brainwashed, bang, you go that way. And the brainwashing kind of carries you in a certain direction. And then you go according to that. So this is the idea, this is why the Kalyanamitta is so important in the Buddhist teachings. Because without it, there is no way of getting out. There's no circuit breaker to say stop. Be careful, watch out, there's something more going on here. What is so marvelous, and this is, I think, one of the things that the Buddha, after his awakening, the Buddha says, nobody will understand this. Yeah, it's just too profound. How can anyone understand this? It goes completely against the stream of the world. The stream of the world is to express the ego, to express our sense of self, this is so ingrained in human beings. How are they going to understand things that go completely against that? And this is so that even the Buddha said this is impossible. And then he goes out and he teaches. And when he gives his first teaching, which is the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which we will have a look at later on, then of course the miracle happens that Kondanya was his name, the first disciple of the Buddha to understand the teachings. He understands. And the Buddha exclaims, Kondanya understands, Kondanya understands. It's as if the Buddha is amazed that somebody can actually understand these teachings. And then later on, the Buddha talks about the various kinds of marvels, or if you like, miracles or wonders in the world. And the Buddha dismisses the idea of things like supernormal powers. He dismisses that as that's not the real marvel. The real marvel is the marvel of instruction. That is possible for someone to realize these teachings and then teach others and they realize the same thing. That is the real marvel. It may not seem like a marvel until you understand how profound it is. Yeah, and this is why we come back to this particular thing here. You hear what you have not heard before. This is actually a very profound statement. You hear something which is very profound, very deep, something you cannot hear anywhere else. The Buddha becomes your spiritual friend. He is the one who carries you along. And then you have a chance to reach the same destiny or the same awakening as the Buddha himself did. So this is why this matters so much. And the second one is about clarifying what you have heard. So it's not just about hearing it once, but it is often about hearing it again and again and again from slightly different angles and slightly different ways. When you read the suttas, one of the marvelous things that you find in the suttas is that they say often the same thing from slightly different angles in slightly different ways. This is one of the kind of the abilities of the Buddha to teach the Dhamma so that you see it from all these different angles and things. And gradually you start to see the whole picture. And one of the ways that I like to look at the Dhamma is almost like a jigsaw puzzle. All these pieces coming together, they actually, in the end, it creates one large picture. That's the picture of the Dhamma. But all of this large picture can be divided up into sub-factors, which are the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. But when you have an insight, what you see is bang, you see the whole thing, the whole picture in one go. You understand what is there. But it's gradual. Stage by stage. So you need to hear again and again. And as you hear it again and again, gradually it sinks in. One of the strange things that I found, especially in my early years as a monk, I would read the sutta and I would put it aside, think, I understood that. Of course I hadn't, but anyway, that's what I thought. And I bring it back out again after a few months or maybe a couple of years. And I read it, wow, this is just so different. It's not actually the same sutta anymore. Something has happened with you in the meantime. Something has matured. You've been listening to more teachings. You have more ability to cross-reference to other suttas. Your meditation is going a bit better. Whatever it is, bring it out again. It looks like a different sutta. It has a different meaning to you. And hopefully this is also what will happen gradually with every one of you as well. Even if you feel that you've heard the suttas before, you will actually hear them in a slightly new way. It will be more profound, deeper. You will see it in a different light. So always try to have this idea. There was this book written a long time ago, back in the 70s, called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And it's this idea of approaching everything as if you are a beginner. Not kind of coming with a full head already thinking that you know everything, but coming with an open mind, trying to hear things in a new way. And as you do that, it adds to your understanding of these things. Not having too many preconceptions as you come in here. And gradually, this kind of form forms your view of things. And gradually, you see these things. It's a wonderful thing, isn't it? You come to the Buddha, and the Buddha kind of brainwashes you. And you're so happy about being brainwashed. Usually we think brainwashing is bad, but actually, when it comes to Buddhism, it's really good. We have to be brainwashed. We are brainwashed anyway. So you come and choose the right brainwashing. And of course, that is the Buddhist brainwashing. Why? What is a good brainwashing? What is a bad brainwashing? Bad brainwashing is if it leads you to suffering. Good brainwashing, if it leads you to happiness. So this is kind of the idea here. So it is you have to be brainwashed anyway. Life is just a process of brainwashing, regardless. It's quite a nice idea, isn't it? Life is a process of brainwashing. That's really what it is. And then you have the third factor here. You emerge from perplexity. This is like doubt. Doubts in Buddhism are manifold. You have doubts about the teachings and all of these kind of things. But the Buddha summarizes doubt or lack of doubt as understanding what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. What is good, what is bad, what is useful, what is useless. So this is kind of how you summarize this. And all of the Buddha's teachings are, in a sense, included in this. So you understand all of these teachings can be just looked upon as wholesome or unwholesome. If it is the Dhamma, real Dhamma, it is always going to be wholesome. If it is the wrong Dhamma, it is going to be unwholesome if it leads you astray. But more specifically, it also refers to your meditation practice. The ability to look into your mind and understand what are the defilements of the mind, what are the problems that you have to overcome, how to develop all the right qualities. It may seem surprising, but actually this can often be very difficult to be able to see the blockages in your mind. What is it that stops me from going further? Why is my meditation only going so far? What is the cause for that? And the reason is always a blockage, a hindrance, a defilement that stops you from going further. And the only way you're going to be able to discover what the problem is to investigate, to look at your mind, to see where the problems are and where the what are the good qualities. And as you investigate that, you emerge from perplexity or doubt. Gradually, you start to see more and more clarity what the good qualities are and what the bad qualities are. And this is a very important part of the process of meditation. Yeah, to know yourself. We often don't know ourselves very well. To know what your problems are, where your limitations are. And as you do that, you uncover these problems. And that allows you, as you uncover these things, to go deeper, to find more happiness, to find more peace, deeper and deeper and deeper. It's a gradual process, this emergence from perplexity. And only when you attain deep samadhi, yeah, for those of you who have some samadhi experiences and you have entered a jhana state or something like that, when the hindrances are completely gone, that is the first time you fully understand what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. Because when the hindrances are completely gone, you know what the pure mind is like. And only with that access, direct understanding of the purity of the mind can you gather what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. In the meantime, we're kind of fumbling around a little bit in the dark, but gradually you emerge from darkness. This is one of the wonderful things about the Buddhist path, how you gradually emerge from darkness, emerge from delusion. Gradually light gets turned on, gradually you see more clearly. Is that kind of a wonderful idea? You start to see the world with more clarity. You understand what is going on. You have a feeling of coming out of this cloud of uncertainty, this delusion, which kind of is, you know, you don't understand what's going on really. And gradually coming out, you see more and more clearly. You understand what reality is about. And this is the what happens on this path if you practice in the right way. It's very beautiful. A clear mind is such a beautiful thing compared to a confused mind or a deluded mind. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. If you feel confused or deluded or whatever, it feels terrible. When you have clarity, yes, now you know what is the right thing to do. Often I think about how I lead my monastic life sometimes. And sometimes as a monastic, you feel like you had enough, these fellow monks, they are terrible, or I've had enough of my fellow monks. My fellow monks are really great, actually. They're really wonderful people. It's just that sometimes you get deluded with your own stupid thinking. So then I realize that whenever I feel like that, all I have to do is wait till I get clarity again. Once clarity is back, you know what is the right thing to do. Never make decisions when your mind is unclear or confused. Because then you don't know what you're doing, basically. Emerging from perplexity is a wonderful thing here. And then you straighten out your view. The view, the first factor of the Noble Path, this is the Ujjukaditti, is also one of the factors for being able to do your meditation practice. It is one of the bases for doing Satipatthana, which is all about watching the breath and all the meditation practices. So the idea of Ujjukaditti is absolutely foundational. We're going to have a look when we come to the Noble Eightfold Path at some stage, not sure when it's going to be, but quite soon. Then, of course, you start to see the causality of the Noble Eightfold Path. One of the things about the Noble Eightfold Path is that it is not just eight factors kind of put together at random. There's nothing in Buddhism which is random, really. It is a particular sequence, and that sequence unfolds in a particular way. And because right view is at the root of that sequence, it is also the most important factor on the Noble Eightfold Path from getting started, from getting things kind of going. So that's how important it is, yeah? So as you straighten out your view, again, this is a gradual process. Your view gets straighter and straighter and straighter gradually over time. It takes a long time for that to happen. One of the things which is interesting for me, I remember when I was going to become wanted to become a Buddhist monk. Yeah, I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. I thought being a Buddhist monk was a really good thing. So I sort of was very stubborn about I'm going to become a Buddhist monk. My family, of course, were not very happy about it at all. and uh, And of course, the reason why your family is not happy about it, and remember this, is because they don't really understand. Their view isn't straight. They don't know what they're saying. Yeah, it's very, very common in all families. If a son or daughter wants to go forth and become a monastic, they say, why on earth? You know, you have got a good education, you've got everything in life, and you want to become a monastic. What's wrong with you? What have we, you know? And the reason, the only reason they say that is because they haven't got a clue what they're talking about. So remember that. This is such an important thing because it means that you, when sometimes it is right to be stubborn, sometimes it's right because you know you're doing the right thing. Yeah, it's of course listening to your parents doesn't always mean to take on board exactly what they say verbatim. Sometimes you have to look at the broader picture and see what is going to be for the long-term benefit of yourself and everyone else. So this idea of right view is so important. If people haven't got right view, they don't know what's going on. So you gradually change this, gradually as you listen to the suttas, and the suttas really, what are the suttas? The suttas is one big collection of right view. Essentially, every time you read the sutta, you're kind of allowing yourself to increase in right view if you are attentive and you are aware of what is going on. Emerging from darkness, moving into light, seeing the world in a new way, very powerful new way as you do that. So right view is so important, and this is what we come back to. Eventually, this, of course, also becomes more powerful with your meditation practice, and the deeper your meditation is, the more ability you have to see things in the right way, until one day, hopefully, you will get your view 100% straightened out. That's why when you have samadhi here. Then we have the last one here, the mind becomes placid. Pasidati means like the mind becomes confident, the mind becomes calm. Yeah, placid means like calm, it doesn't have any ripples or anything to it. This is in many ways one of the most profound aspects of why listening to the Dhamma is so useful. Remember, the Buddha's teaching tends to be sequential and gradual. And right here also there is a sequence here. The beginning is about hearing what hasn't been heard and you clarify what you have heard. And eventually the last one is about the mind becoming placid. There comes a point when you know enough Dhamma. Yeah, you heard enough suttas, you know about all the you feel confidence in these teachings. And when you start to feel that confidence in the teachings, you start to listen to the Dhamma for other reasons. When you read the suttas, instead of just getting information from the suttas, you start to feel inspired. You feel, wow, this is so beautiful, because you know how it works. You have enough experience yourself in your meditation practice, in your virtue, in doing all the right things, that when you see that, you feel, wow, this is just so nice. And then you feel inspired as you are listening to the sutta. One of the monks I know, he told me that when he was chanting the Metta Sutta, at the monastery we often do some chanting together, he said at one stage he felt so much power, so much joy, so much happiness just by chanting the Metta Sutta. He wasn't able to continue chanting. The power of the Metta Sutta, because he understood its meaning in a very profound sense, meant that all he had was this incredible bliss in his mind. And this is, in a sense, what is meant by this in a very high, when these things start to kind of come out and become very powerful. You understand the meaning, and actually it helps you to bliss out. It helps you to become calm. It helps you to become peaceful. It helps you to be inspired. And this is, in many ways, the most important aspect of listening to the Dhamma. You have a number of suttas where the Buddha talks about how awakening is achieved. And very often, awakening is achieved by listening to the Buddha's teachings, the mind becoming peaceful and calm. Then you enter samadhi, and because the teachings are so close to you, that is when you can gain that insight into the teachings. So going on a retreat and hearing some suttas or reading the suttas for yourself, that is often the time when these things happen, because you get all the right factors coming together in this way. So remember this, it's a kind of a twofold thing. Reading suttas is about understanding the teachings intellectually, but it's also about getting the inspiration, the wow factor. You think, whoa, this is just so beautiful. Once you start to understand that these teachings really touch on the very meaning of life, they really go to the core of what it is, how to live our lives in a meaningful way, how to attain real happiness, get away from suffering. Once you understand all that, you start to become so happy that you have come across these things, because you know this is what it's all about, basically. Okay, so that is just the idea there of you of listening to the Dhamma, and so I think it's fairly obvious the benefits there, and So now I'm going to go on to the next little sutta here. This is from the Digha Nikaya 29, called the Pasadika Sutta. And this sutta has many nice little things in it. And it's one of the suttas. We'll come back to the sutta later on. This is just one extract. We'll have a look at another extract afterwards. And this particular sutta was spoken, I think, quite close to the Buddha's passing away. For that reason, the Buddha is kind of here setting out some of the ways in which the Dhamma will be preserved for the future. Some of the core aspects of the Dhamma are set out in the sutta. In a similar way to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha talks about the last days of his life. Yeah, he's traveled from Rajagaha to Kushinara, where he passed away. That's also where he sets out kind of his legacy and what is going to be passed on for the future generations and how to preserve the Dhamma. This sutta is a little bit like that. So for that reason, again, it's quite interesting, and it kind of gives a nice overview. So let's have a quick look at this. And this is what the Buddha says. It was Uddaka Ramaputta who used to say, "He sees but does not see. What is it? What is that seeing one does not see? You can see the blade of a well-sharpened razor, but not its edge." That is what he meant by saying, "He sees but does not see." He spoke in reference to a low, ordinary, worldly, ignoble thing of no spiritual significance, a mere razor. So here we have this character, Uddaka Ramaputta, and you may recognize this person. This is one of the Buddha's early teachers. Yeah, when the Buddha, after he went forth into the homeless life, he sought out the spiritual teachers of India at that time. One of them was called Alara Kalama. The other one was Uddaka Ramaputta. And they were presumably quite famous spiritual teachers at that time, because they crop up in the suttas every now and again in various contexts. And so they probably would have been fairly well known as spiritual teachers. And here you have it again. So here the Buddha is kind of quoting his old teacher, Uddaka Ramaputta. And he's not all that impressed with him. Yeah, that's obviously quite clear here. He sees, but he does not see. And he's talking about the razor. You cannot see its edge, because if it is really sharp, the edge is too thin, presumably. That's presumably the point here. Buddha is not too impressed. So now the Buddha will say what he actually means by this, seeing but not seeing. If one were to use that expression properly, "he sees but does not see," it would be like this. When he sees a holy life, which is fully complete with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity, if he were to deduct anything from it, thinking, "In this way it will be pure," he does not see it. And if he were to add anything to it, thinking, "In this way it will be more complete," then he does not see that either. That is the meaning of the saying, "He sees but does not see." Therefore, Chunda, if anyone were to refer to any holy life as being fully complete, it is this holy life that they should be describing. So the point of the Buddha here is that the holy life, as proclaimed by the Buddha, you see it, it's there, you have all the monastics and all the people practicing this life, the Buddha says, what you cannot see is anything that is either lacking or superfluous. Buddha is saying, this holy life that I have described, it has all the elements that are required for awakening. And he says this elsewhere as well, in various ways. Nothing superfluous, nothing lacking. Everything is there. And this has very, again, very powerful implications for how we understand the Buddha's teachings. Why is that? Well, because what it means is that if we go back to the word of the Buddha, assuming that we know what the word of the Buddha is, and we do to a very large extent, we know what the word of the Buddha is, if we go back to the word of the Buddha, that is all that is required. It is always one of those things that I found so remarkable, is that at the time of the Buddha, when all you had were the suttas, you didn't even have all the suttas because the Buddha was in the middle of proclaiming them. You had some of the suttas. At that time, that is when you had the most arahants. Yeah, you had lots of arahants in those days. Lots of people were enlightened. And the further away you get from the Buddha, the more writings we have and the less arahants you have. You know what I mean? Now we have kind of this whole wall over here could probably be filled up with kind of Pali books if you wanted to, all trying to explain the path, but the number of arahants has dwindled to an absolute minimum. How many arahants are there in the world today? Do you know? Have you counted them? Not so many. Yeah, if you go around trying to find arahants, it's actually not that easy to find arahants these days. That is my personal experience. The longer I'm a monk, the kind of fewer arahants there seems to be around. When you start out in the monastic life in the world, or as a Buddhist, you think, yeah, there's probably arahants everywhere. You haven't really got a clue. But as you start looking at things, you become more and more skeptical about some of these so-called arahants. You go on the internet, you see, yeah, I am an arahant, yeah? And you think, wait a minute, maybe that's not quite right. Is this how arahants act? Maybe not. So this is profound. Yeah, it has very powerful implications. You go back to the suttas. That is where the real teachings are. Don't have to worry about everything else. So the first question then is, do we know what these suttas are? And in large part, we do. And this is one of the things that there's a little booklet that I wrote with Adnan Sujato and myself wrote back in 2012, I think it was. It was quite a long project called The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts. Yeah, and if you're interested, you can find that online. And we are very proud, of course, because that was published by the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies. Yeah, so we're very happy about that because it's quite prestigious. Yeah. So it was published there, and very recently, and this was also very nice, there was one of the top academics in early Buddhist studies. He really praised this booklet and said it was one of the best things around to explain and understand early, the early Buddhism and what is authentic and what is not. So I just saw that yesterday, actually. I came across this more or less by accident when this he was referring specifically to our book and said this is the gold standard for what is... for knowing the authenticity of early Buddhist texts. So I'm just saying that just to kind of give it a bit of, not because I'm too proud about it, but just to kind of give it a bit of support, yeah, that we have been doing the right thing. So we know pretty much what the word of the Buddha is. In broad outline, we may not know exactly verbatim everything he says. He said there is always some degree of uncertainty with some of these things, but the broad picture, the broad outline, the Noble Eightfold Path, all the main teachings, we can be very certain, I think, that these actually were taught by the Buddha. Where do you find that? You find it in the four Nikayas mainly, the long discourse of the Buddha, the middle-length discourse of the Buddha, the connected discourse of the Buddha, and the numerical discourse of the Buddha. Yeah, this is the real deal. Yeah, when you go there, this is the word of the Buddha. When you read that, your hair should stand on end. Yeah, because, I'm in the presence of the Buddha. That's how you should feel when you go back to those Nikayas. So what does that mean in terms of how we practice the Buddhist teachings? One of the problems with modern Buddhism is that too many people, instead of going back to the source, going back to these teachings that are complete, in which there is nothing lacking and there's nothing superfluous, instead of going there, they go to other teachings instead. And these teachings are, first of all, there's many types of teachings, but there are things like the Abhidhamma is one. The saying in many kind of Theravadan circles is that the Abhidhamma is like the complete understanding of Buddhism. Yeah, if you want the full understanding, the Paramatta Satcha, the ultimate truth of Buddhism, you have to go to the Abhidhamma. That's not what the Buddha said. The Buddha said that his system is already complete. You don't need anything beyond his system. If you go to the Abhidhamma, you're going to a later literature that came after the Buddha. Yeah, maybe 150, 200 years after the Buddha, and there is no doubt that it is later than the Buddha. People may not say that, but it's very obvious if you can read a bit of Pali and you compare the Pali. It's a different language, different vocabulary, different style, different everything. There are so many, it's so easy to know that the Abhidhamma was not taught by the same person who taught the suttas. The Buddha didn't teach this. So, you know, what it means is that once you are moving on to these things, like the Abhidhamma, the Visuddhimagga, another thing which almost is the identity of Theravada Buddhism in the world, is the Visuddhimagga. Yeah, this is one of those teachings, large, expansive works in Theravada Buddhism that everybody uses to help them with their insight practice and all of these things. But it was written almost 1,000 years after the Buddha. Yeah, okay, it quotes from the suttas, of course, a lot. Still, some of that material is much, much later than the Buddha. The Buddha says there's nothing missing. So why exactly do we need the Visuddhimagga? Why do we need all these other things? Do we really need them? And the answer is not really. What we should do is go back to the earliest teachings, and that should be the foundation upon which we base our spiritual life. And then we're going to have the best possible results. And very often what happens is that once you have read all the Abhidhamma, all the Visuddhimagga, many other commentaries, then when you come to the suttas, you already have a fixed opinion about what the suttas are about. And you can't really read them neutrally anymore. You read them through a certain lens, the lens of the commentaries, the lens of all of these other things. And it becomes very hard to come back to the authentic and real teachings of the Buddha. So please be very careful with this, because this, I think, is a very big problem in the Buddhist world, and it's very hard. Of course, the problem is also that sometimes we need to interpret the suttas in the right way, and that is where it gets very tricky, because sometimes you need a bit of guidance and all of these kind of things. So it is not completely one-sided, of course, but the main emphasis should always be to go back to the suttas, go back to the word of the Buddha. These are the real teachings. This is what it is really all about. This is where you get the best instructions for the Dhamma. Nothing missing, yeah? Nothing superfluous. And this is the good thing about this. So nothing missing. What about nothing superfluous part? This is also interesting. Because the idea of nothing being superfluous means that when you read the suttas, you start to read them much more carefully. You understand that the Buddha, when he says something, he really means it. Every word is important. Yeah, every word has a potential meaning. So you start to read them in a slightly different way. You read them with care. You take into account everything the Buddha says. You reflect on it and try to kind of get to the bottom and the root of what he's talking about. And as you do so, you are reading these teachings in the right and in the appropriate way. So a very simple thing, yeah, the Buddha is saying. It's so simple, and yet the implications are so profound, because very few people live their Buddhist life in this way. The vast majority of people, they just listen to this teacher, to that teacher, they go to Abhidhamma school, yeah, hear the Abhidhamma. I was in Malaysia a while ago, and I was they're very nice centers called the Buddhist Gem Fellowship in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And they have a very kind of four-story building, very nice, very modern and very good. And I had my own room, yeah. When you go, you get very nice accommodation as a monk when you travel around. And next door to my room, they had this large lecture theater. And while I was staying in my room, I had already this incredibly burdensome teaching schedule. Yeah, they're really squeezing everything out of me. Absolutely. you wonder why you become a monk sometimes. And that's actually very nice. I enjoy it when people are excited about the Dhamma, because I get a bit excited about the Dhamma myself. But then I want to go back to my room afterwards and just chill, yeah, because you already have kind of squeezed everything out of your poor little brain already. And then I go back to my room, and then they start the Abhidhamma class next door, yeah. So this lady gets on the microphone, and she talks Abhidhamma for, I don't know, what is it, 4 hours or something? And I thought, oh. At least if they taught suttas, I thought it would have been more inspiring. But she goes on with this Abhidhamma for 4 hours. And I wanted to go in there, and I wanted to ask, well, you know, why do you... why do you do this? What do you do this for? No, you can't really do that. That would be really rude if I did that. But you can, and this is kind of a lot. And the funny thing was that the classes that I were given, I think there were less people coming to the talks I were given that came to the Abhidhamma class. Yeah, I mean, so many people interested in Abhidhamma. Early suttas, yeah, no, forget about the early suttas. Yeah, Abhidhamma, this is the real deal. This is So it's kind of, to me, it was slightly despairing when you see that, because it is so obvious to me that people are just getting it the wrong way around. Yeah, the Abhidhamma is not where it's at. And also, it's very loud, the Abhidhamma. That was what I found when I was there. That also was the kind of the wrong idea with that. So that is often how people are in the world today. This is how often we go about the Buddhist teachings. And I think we often get it the wrong way around. And that can be problematic. Actually, it is problematic. So you can now see why I like to read out these suttas at the beginning, because it sets the stage for the suttas later on. I just want you to feel reasonably confident that what we're doing here is something worthwhile. Yeah, we're going to try to get to the core of what these teachings are about. Then the Buddha says, therefore, Chunda, all you to whom I have taught these truths that I have realized by super knowledge, you should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning and expression beside expression, without dissension, in order that this holy life may continue and be established for a long time, for the profit and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, profit, and happiness of devas and humans. What are the things that you should recite together? They are the four applications of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four steps to spiritual power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven factors of awakening, the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things you should recite together. So the Buddha says here, the truths that I have taught after realizing by my own knowledge, this is abhinya here, Maurice Walsh translated as super knowledge. So whatever, abhinya is like direct insight, really, through insight, you could say. And of course, this is already an important point. The Buddha is not a philosopher. He doesn't kind of think out systems, you know, by thinking it out. The Buddha's teachings come from his own personal realization. This is kind of the whole point of these teachings, that they are realized. And because of that, once you kind of get your mind around that, you get a sense of confidence about that, it becomes very inspiring, because this is reality. This is about understanding human psychology, what it is to be a being, understanding our nature to its foundations. This is what this is about, from direct insight. And so these are truths that you can see through insight. And of course, that is a very important part of this. And what this truth is in this particular context is largely the path of practice to take you all the way to awakening. So these things, you should come together and recite them, says the Buddha. And this, of course, is what happened in later times after the Buddha passed away, but also here, perhaps before he passed away. The monastics would come together, they would recite these teachings. And when you come together and recite things, of course, what happens is that you can weed out any errors. If everybody kind of recites them together, you say, oh, wait a minute, that's, you know, what you're saying there is not right. Or the one person who gets it wrong will get corrected, or whatever it is. So this is kind of the way of preserving the teachings for the long term, by reciting them together. And this is why I think it is fairly, it is not overstating the case that you actually, it is possible to remember these teachings very well over long periods of time by reciting, because there was a system in place that actually enabled the Sangha to remember these things. Remember, the idea of reciting texts had already existed in India for over 1,000 years before the Buddha came on the scene. The Vedas, the ancient Brahmanical texts, had also been recited orally very accurately for hundreds and hundreds of years. So there was already a system in place for how to do these things in ancient India. So you come together, recite them together, setting meaning beside meaning, expression beside expression. So you make sure that these things are recited correctly. Yeah, not only the expression, but also the meaning. Yeah? Have you understood it in the right way? Okay, you may have got the meaning, the expression right, but what about the meaning of these things? Correcting each other to ensure that it is passed on from generation to generation in the right way. Yeah? Without dissension, the idea of coming together in harmony, yes, and abiding in harmony is so important and yet so difficult somehow to carry out in reality. Yeah? In order that this holy life may continue and be established for a long time for the profit and happiness of everyone, out of compassion for the world, etc., of devas and humans. And I think this is such an important thing to remember about the Buddhist teachings. The whole purpose of these teachings is to be there for our happiness, for the reduction of suffering in our lives. That's why we carry them on. That's why we bring them from one generation to the next one. That's why we practice them ourselves. This is what it is all about. And sometimes the Buddhist teachings get hijacked for all kinds of other reasons. Sometimes they get hijacked because we are proud of these teachings. Yeah, these are my teachings. And we kind of have a nice cupboard with glass, you know, and we put all the books in there, we lock it up, and then we worship those teachings. These are my books. We never open those books, of course, but we just worship them. We come down and bow down to them every day or whatever. And this is very common. It happens around the world. That's not the point of these teachings. They don't work if you just bow down to them. Yeah, you've got to practice, you've got to read them, you've got to do something with them. And sometimes these teachings get used for all kind of terrible purposes. Sometimes we get too attached to them. We get attached to the idea of being Buddhists, and it becomes a cause for nationalism. And it is so easy, and you can understand why that is the case, but that is not what these things are for. Once they become a part of a nationalistic agenda, then, of course, they become a source of suffering instead. Because once you have nationalism, then you have clashes. Because once you are nationalistic about something, there will be the insiders, there will be the outsiders. And that is where problems start to arise. So these teachings are there for the happiness of people. If they are no longer there for the happiness of people, they lose their meaning. Yeah, they lost their meaning. It is almost better not to be a Buddhist, yeah, and to have peace rather than to be a Buddhist and use the teachings in the wrong way. So important to remember this as we do these things. And I have always felt that the right way of thinking about yourself is to think about yourself as a practicing Buddhist. Instead of thinking, I'm a Buddhist, what I'm actually really trying to do is to practice these teachings. And if you are a practicing Buddhist, then it doesn't really lead to that clash in the same way. And of course, everyone here is basically a very sincere practicing Buddhist. I barely need to tell you that, but I think these are still important matters to keep in mind. So what are these things that should be recited in this way? And they are this set that I just read out before. And these things are called the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. If you add up all of those factors, you get to 37. If you don't get to 37, you will have revolutionized the Buddhist teachings, because it has been 37 for a long time. These are known as the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the 37 factors on the side of awakening, pakkhya's side, on the side. So these are the supports for awakening. What is interesting about these 37, as you will see there, they are all very practical matters. They're all about the path of practice. You have the four applications of mindfulness, the satipatthanas. You have the four right efforts. All of this, of course, has to do with meditation, how we apply ourselves. The four steps to spiritual power, the four roads to power, they're called here, iddhipadas, is all about samadhi practice. The five spiritual faculties, well, these are the faculties that awaken in you, especially when you become an Arya, when you become a noble one. These things become established inside of you as a part of your psychology, if you like. Five mental power, just another way of looking at the five spiritual faculties. The seven factors of awakening, sambhujangas, satta sambhujangas, these are an expansion on the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is about sammasati, right mindfulness, and right stillness, right samadhi. And very last, you have the Noble Eightfold Path. So when you look at that list, you realize that basically those 37 factors, it's really just an expansion in many ways, different angles to take on the Noble Eightfold Path. It really comes back to the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path summarizes all of these 37 factors. The first four foundations of mindfulness, that is, click in, they kind of slot in the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, the four efforts, they slot in on the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Four roads to power slot in on the last factor, etc., etc. So it is just an expansion. So the Noble Eightfold Path really summarizes these 37 factors. So that is why I'm going to focus on the Noble Eightfold Path during this retreat, and all of those other factors will be included as well as part of that. So these factors, then again, they are very practical. They have to do with the practice. And perhaps you wonder, what about the theory? Very often in Buddhism, we talk about things that may seem more theoretical. What about the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, all of this? How does that actually, is that also part of this? And the answer is yes, this is also part of this. And if you know your sutta as well, you know, of course, the Four Noble Truths is really just the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's about right view. Yeah, right view is about understanding the Four Noble Truths correctly. And the Four Noble Truths, in turn, there you have the second noble truth about the origin of suffering and about the ending of suffering. And that is really all about dependent origination. So that also is part of this. So this is really, even though it is about practice, the more slightly theoretical aspect of the path are also included in this as well. There is no such thing as practice without theory, because you have to have a framework in which the practice works, or which the practice makes sense. Yeah, you have to have some kind of idea, some kind of outlook on the world that makes the teachings meaningful and make them work. And when you see the world in the right way, that is when these things actually come into play and they start working. So theory and practice always go together to some extent. That is what this is. That is what my point really about this is. So that is what the Buddha tells us we should focus on, these 37 factors of awakening. We should not focus on unnecessary philosophizing or all kind of other things. This is kind of the essence of what the Buddha's teaching is about. It's about getting us out of suffering and moving us towards the ultimate happiness of the Buddhist path. This is the purpose of this, for the happiness, the benefit, and the profit of devas and human beings, and then you know that you are on the right track. So this is what we are going to be talking about on this retreat, coming back to the very core, the very thing that the Buddha himself says is the purpose of this, the very thing that he says is the essence of his own teachings. This is what we will be having a look at. And this is why I read these things out, to give you that sense of framework, sense of broad understanding as we start out. Okay, so there you are. That is all for this morning. And we will continue with the suttas again at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And in the meantime, just continue just enjoying yourself, and then we will just take it stage by stage. So see you again at 3 o'clock.